described Enterprise Library as a swan, right? A beautiful swan?
Calm and graceful on the surface and paddling like mad under the water.
Okay, go ahead.
Geeks are so hot.
Welcome, Elegant Coders, to this almost New Year's edition of the Elegant Codecast. And before you even begin listening to this really good episode that has a lot of meat in it, I want to apologize for a couple things. First of all, being that every time I think I get the formula for perfect audio recording down, I apparently didn't. And that is certainly true in this episode. And it really does sound like every time I touch my keyboard, I'm dropping a bomb into the audio track. So I apologize for that. And I think I'm on to something. I'm going to be trying a new microphone here soon in the new year. Also, I put WD-40 all over my chair so that it doesn't squeak like mice underfoot. Before we get started with our interview with Chris Tavares, let's take a look at a couple of good tweets for the week. Glenn Block: Mommy, can I please play Wii Now? Me wishing I could ask my mom for that. And from This Is Pointless, which is just an awesome Twitter feed to follow, it's Billy Hollis: Amazon had a sale on Halo action figures. I bought 7. One of them has already lost his arm. Who buys 7 Halo action figures? And Elijah Manor, ELIJAHMANOR: Turns out that many stores don't carry Heelys in a size 8. They kept thinking I was looking for my 3-year-old, but I was like, no, it's for me. It's apparently a grown man who wants to wear Heelys. Excellent. Now on to a really good discussion with Chris Tavares, lead developer of the Enterprise Library at Microsoft's Patterns and Practices team, Unity Project. That was his baby. So a lot of good stuff from Chris. Joining us on this discussion, thank goodness, were Jared Ferguson and Scott Nichols, both Elegant Coders held in high esteem. Without further ado, Happy New Year, folks, and here you go.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, my name is Chris Tavares. I find it useful to actually pronounce my last name for people because they tend to screw it up otherwise. Not that I'm used to that or anything. I've been a professional developer for about 15 years now. Right now, I'm a senior developer at the Microsoft Patterns and Practices Group. I've been at P&P for about 3 years. I've had the good fortune to work on almost all of the P&P projects in that time frame, or the current projects anyway. Currently, I am the dev lead and architect on Enterprise Library. Before coming to P&P, I've done a disgustingly wide range of things. I've worked on shrink-wrap software, development tools, embedded systems, and even a little bit of mainframe work way back in the college days.
In your capacity with Intlib today, can you describe sort of what your day is like and how you contribute to Enterprise Library?
Sure. Well, we're in a little bit of a pause right now, so my current day is like I'm very lazy. So let's talk about what happens when the project's actually in flight. My job as dev lead is kind of, I own the code. So I am responsible for, of course, writing some of the software, but on a higher level, I manage our software development process. That includes things like keeping track of our task board on the wall, so we know who's doing what, keeping track of when things are getting done. I also provide architectural and code reviews when necessary, pair programming as much as possible, suggestions and approaches for architectural or design decisions, or sometimes it will, or helping explain to the test people how something is supposed to work. It's really kind of the buck stops here in the dev, sort of the, I don't know, the code janitor, maybe?
I like that, code janitor. Perfect. We've had a couple of folks from P&P on in the past, and, you know, you guys have got a pretty thriving cerebral community there. So just give us a little elevator pitch on what P&P is. And how that might be different than working in a product group at Microsoft.
Sure. So PMP is the Patterns and Practices group. In the end, our goal, we're all about Windows platform adoption. We want people working on the Microsoft platform. Now, the way we have done that is not by, you know, sales pitches or holding people down and hitting them in the head and selling down until they buy a Windows license. Instead, we chose to...
That's the other group.
Yeah, that's the marketing that's the marketing sales guys. So the approach we use is to talk to the senior devs and the architects in organizations, or specifically, typically we've geared towards them. The idea being those guys are the technical decision makers, and if we give them best practices, approaches to deal with typical problem spaces, usually in the enterprise, because we concentrated on the enterprise space, on how to do things well on the Microsoft platform, where well it depends on your definition. You know, is it scalable? Is it bug-free? Is it maintainable? That sort of thing. Then we will get Windows in those organizations or keep them in those organizations. It's also kind of grown over time in that a lot of both internal and external people look to PNP as the keeper of the best practices for programming onto Windows, which is both a gratifying and really, really scary place to be. It's certainly nice to be looked to for that kind of guidance. The downside is that you've got to be very, very careful that you don't screw up, because you will hear about it.
So I take it that's from experience.
Yes. Well, both from us personally and watching other groups at Microsoft get hit with stuff like that. The recent MD framework vote of no confidence thing, for example.
Why, I know not of what you speak. No, I'm kidding. So say a little bit about that, because the story of how Microsoft dealt with that is, I think, compelling and encouraging. So why don't you tell us what happened there?
Well, I mean, I agree with you completely. I think that it's a very good sign that the Entity Framework team has learned from their flubs. Like many other big organizations, we do tend to have a little bit of a not invented here. And, you know, we can say, yeah, we're looking outside. We're looking in Building 34. You know? When people don't... And there's also a large number of people at Microsoft who came into Microsoft straight out of college, have never done anything but look at frameworks, or work on frameworks as opposed to actually building apps on those frameworks. And so there's been a long history of tunnel vision. And just looking inside, you know, okay, here's what I know we need to do, and everybody else, you know, we don't care about what you think because we know what's right. And that has been changing for the better in many ways through many groups over the last year or two. Both the Entity Framework team opening up, and particularly the people that they got on their new advisory board for EF, are some of the luminaries in the spaces that the people who are complaining about really respect. So I'm hoping that, and as long as they actually listen to them, and all the indications are that they are listening to them, Entity Framework going forward will become much, much better. I'm also very heartened with what's happening, particularly at ASP.NET and in Scott Guthrie's organization, where there's been much more open. The fact that they've actually been releasing the source code to like the new ASP.NET MVC framework is a fantastic thing. Now, we in PNP have been doing things like that for much longer, so we kind of feel it's a vindication. Called customer-connected engineering. You know, every one of our projects has an advisory board running of non-Microsoft people in the domain that we're targeting for that particular project, and we do make changes as things come up on the advisory board. We're very active on our Codeplex communities, for example, and we all monitor various mailing lists and whatnot to see what people have to say.
So people ask me all the time, how can I actually get somebody at Microsoft to pay attention? And what you're saying is you do pay attention. You guys spend some part of your time monitoring the community.
Exactly.
So could you tell us a little bit about how Unity came to be? Kind of in that vein, was that something that kind of came from the community, kind of a grassroots type thing, or?
Well, Unity is an interesting case. So for those who don't know, Unity is a dependency injection slash inversion of control container. It was originally released in, I think it was May, and then we just released version 1.2 at the end of October. The definition of inversion control is very fuzzy. It's the basic idea is called the Hollywood principle. Don't call us, we'll call you. You know, your objects don't exist in isolation unless they're very low level. They need to call other objects to do their thing. So how do those objects get the sub-objects that they need? You could just say new sub-object. Well, that's okay, except if that sub-object is, say, a database connection, you have now coupled that implementation to your specific database and potentially even to your connection string. And as a result, if you want to go to test that, you know, we're very big into unit testing and test-driven development and agile programming. You've basically hamstrung yourself. You can't test that thing without having a live database. So we tend to abstract that out, and you want to pass in the dependent upon objects into your objects under the objects that are running. This makes it much easier to test them because you can just new up stubs or mocks in your unit test, pass them into the object, call it, check, you know, that the state changed as appropriate, things were called as you want, which is great for testing. But now in your application, you have this wonderful question of, okay, now where do I new up all of these objects? All you've done is move the problem. So the idea of a DI slash IOC, DI stands for dependency injection. It's there is a article by Martin Fowler which kind of talks in more detail about dependency injection and inversion of control, and we could probably put a link to that in the show notes.
Indeed, yeah.
That the idea is that you have a separate object whose responsibility is to wire everything else up. So you can set it and say, okay, if somebody asks for a database, give them this object. If somebody asks for this web service connection, give them that object. Somebody asks for a logger, give them this object. And then you tell, instead of newing up your object, say, container, give me my process object. And the container will look at the process object and say, oh, you need these three things in your constructor. So we'll pull one up out of the container. Oh, that needs these other things. The container will do it, and it wires up your whole object graph according to the configuration of your container.
Right on. And so Unity is a container for doing exactly that, it sounds like.
Exactly, yes.
So why did the world need another one, Chris?
That's
what inquiring minds want to know, baby.
That is excellent. So there are a couple of reasons. Well, first off, I would like to respond to some of the naysayers that are like, why is PNP jumping into this now? PNP has been in the DI space for years. Going back to Nlib 2.0 and the composite UI application block, which was released in, you know, 2005, 2006, somewhere around there. Actually, even earlier. And so we've thought that this DI style of development has a lot of good value, and we want to promulgate that. And we've, in fact, done DI containers before. In fact, we've done, I think, 3 or 4 of them. And every single one of them was different. And every one of our projects kept reinventing DI and doing it slightly differently and specialized for that one particular project. So that we have a DI container in CAB, we had a DI container in the web client software factory, we had a DI-like thing in Nlib under the hood. We were about to build another one for the Prism / Composite WPF guidance. So I actually made a pitch a while ago to our program management team. It's basically said, look, we're doing this thing over and over again. Why are we wasting time? Let's just build a container and have it common across all our stuff. So in many ways, it was a response to our stuff and our internal needs getting out of hand. I'm sure the next question is, why didn't we use one of the existing ones, right?
Well, I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, there is. I mean, at the time we started with Unity, there was, and I think the major players were Spring.net, Windsor, and StructureMap had been around for a while, but it was just starting to pick up a little visibility. Several others have come out of the woodwork, and I don't mean to say that like they're fly by night. Things like Ninject and AutoFac are actually very interesting projects. The issue we had is that many of our customers are unfortunately, or fortunately for Microsoft's sake, I will leave that up to you to decide, very leery of open source projects. And if we were going to come out and say, you should use Winsor, they were like, oh, I can't listen to you anymore. I'm not going to pull this open source thing into my project. Plus, not being on the Winsor team, we have absolutely no pull over the direction of that project. So if there was something it didn't do, then we couldn't get it. We wouldn't be able to have a whole lot of influence there necessarily unless we branched it. And thinking back to when it was also one of the reasons that Scott Guthrie made a comment when they were originally announcing the ASP.NET MVC framework at the first alt.NET conference. He made a comment about, yes, and we're not using DI in this framework, a DI container in this framework, because no matter which framework we pick, we're going to piss off two-thirds of the room.
And that's, you know what? That's still a valid point, right?
Right. So, of course, the containers are something that people tend to get passionate about. And to be quite honest, another one of our goals is to get the idea of dependency injection out into the larger community. The people who don't go looking at at alt.NET blogs, who don't go downloading stuff to look at. So by having a DI container from Microsoft, we can get the idea out there. And if they then decide, okay, DI is cool, I don't like the Unity container, at least the bug is in their head and they can go and start building these systems using these things. And it also helps, having a DI container from Microsoft helps for adoption of the idea within Microsoft itself, which I think will benefit the company in the long run as we get better, more maintainable software.
So, in order to propagate that idea out there, do the other application blocks within Intlib already take advantage of Unity, or is that to come?
So we have integration hooks with Unity right now. They use the container a little bit, or I should say they can use the container. Because, you know, Intlib has had over a million downloads at this point, so we don't want to make gigantic changes in the API. So you can continue to use Intlib in the same way that you always had, which has been through static facades, or you can use a Unity container with the Intlib extensions in it. The extensions tell Unity how to read the Intlib configuration information and get all of your Intlib objects out of the Unity container as well. Right now, those two access methods sit by side. Going forward, we want to put the facades on top of the container and make the container the real underlying implementation.
Okay, so let me see if I translate that properly. Object Builder will be replaced with Unity.
Well, isn't Unity currently using Object Builder?
The thing is, Unity is built on top of Object Builder. Right now, Intlib uses Object Builder directly. We will be that, or at least that's the plan. Anything I say future... Where's my SEC warning? You know, current behavior does not guarantee future results, something like that. These are plans, not this...
You're on tape now.
I get yelled at if I don't say that.
No, it's cool.
Yeah. The plan is that, yes, we will remove the requirement on Object Builder in Intlib and replace it with Unity. I would actually like to take that a step forward, if possible, and do something like what our composite guidance for WPF, formerly known as Prism, did, which was actually have a generalized facade that could sit on top of any container.
Is that the service locator that you're referring to?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's currently our top running candidate for what that interface is going to look like. And if at all possible, I would use exactly that.
I've actually seen quite a few open source products or projects that have adopted that already. And so it's good to see PMP getting some traction out there, even in the places where you would least expect it. So.
Yeah, that's actually very, very gratifying. I was the one who actually built that DLL, the Common Service Locator project. It actually started. It was actually a very good example of Microsoft cooperating with the community. It actually started as a post from Jeremy Miller on his blog about it was time for a version of Control Container Detente. Because when you look at all of these containers, the thing that's different is how you configure the thing. The actual mechanics of getting objects out of the containers are really not that different between the various implementations. Right. But the problem was that people writing libraries that use dependency injection end up coupling themselves directly to a particular container, when really they could use any container. But then that results in library A having one abstraction, library B having a different abstraction, library C writing their own abstraction, they all look approximately alike. So we wanted to get one out there which at least was, you know, signed with a Microsoft key, so people wouldn't get the evil open source cooties all over it. And we could, you know, get cooperation to say, look, here, this is good enough. And there were some interesting comments when it first came out, but I think all in all, it was a collaboration between myself and Len Block at and a couple other people at Microsoft, and Oren Aini and Nick Kothari, who's the author of Ninject, and Hamilton D. I'm sorry, Hamilton, I just don't know how to pronounce your last name. He was the author of Castle Windsor, and one of the couple of guys from the Spring.net team. We all got together and defined this interface. It was quite an experience getting that many people together in the community and trying to get them to agree with something for more than 10 minutes at a time.
That's a compelling story. How did you do that? Did that all take place virtually, or did you fly people in, or what?
No, it was all email. It was all done by email. We had a couple of, Glenn Hamilton also works for Microsoft, and myself. We got together in a conference room for an hour. I proposed an interface, and it was decided that, you know, somebody from Microsoft should be the person to actually write the DLL, because that way people from Microsoft could use them in Microsoft products. There wasn't any IP ownership issues. And we just talked it back and forth about what it needed to look like, and we eventually came to agreement, and it was done. And we actually, it took three months to write an interface with six methods on it. So,
just because of the back and forth and give and take on the implementation, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah, and you know, eventually, like any such project, it eventually reached the point with, okay, unless I hear something from you in the next 20 minutes, this is what we're going with. It turns out that works really well.
So are you afforded the opportunity at PMP to look at some of the open source containers, Spring, StructureMap, Windsor? I imagine there's got to be, you know, I've heard of other Microsoft projects that shall not be named, which, you know, explicitly cannot go look at other competing technologies. So I imagine, you know, building an interface like you were building without being able to look at the other containers, you know, might pose a little challenge.
Well, there's look at and there's look at. if there's a public web page with some docs on it or some example code, I can absolutely look at that. I have also been known to email the authors or user groups or mailing lists or whatever and ask questions. In general, what I'm not allowed to look at as a Microsoft developer is the actual source code. Okay. But to be basically, and I've been told this by the legal department, if you can get it in a binary form and just use it, then it's generally okay. You can't actually put it in a product without further vetting by the legal department. But you can look at it. But what I can't look at is the source code.
So does that go for contrib projects as well? Because I know most CodePlex products usually have some sort of contrib going along with it as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes, that does. Our contrib projects, typically, they are actually run by trusted external volunteers who are passionate about it. For example, the Entlib contrib project, the primary coordinator on that is a guy named Olaf Kanchen, who's was one of our big boosters, and he's actually was a vendor dev on some previous versions of Entlib and other PMP projects. And he was very, very passionate about Entlib and wanted to add some of his own stuff. And that wasn't the, we had been planning to put the Contrib project up there to be, anyway. But we've had lots of requests to, hey, wouldn't it be great if you could include this thing in Entlib? And in general, the answer is no, we can't include it in Entlib, but you know, we've got this Entlib Contrib, so if you want to share it, please feel free to add it over here. Now, having said that, our program managers who aren't directly contributing code to the code tree can and do look at the Contrib projects.
So you guys are walking a pretty fine line due to legal and almost a silly line, but one might argue, but you're walking a pretty fine line there, so you have to be careful about how you do it. I get that.
Yeah, yes, you have to be, we have to be careful. It's particularly important in terms of enterprise library because it is used by so many big companies, and one of the things they want is they want 100% guarantee that everything in here is owned 100% by Microsoft.
You know, you mentioned that there are a lot of big companies out there using enterprise library. Who, I'm not asking you to give me company names here, but who in terms of what sort of typical persona cares about enterprise library? Who uses this thing?
And it's the last time I saw the list, and I really wish I could give you names because it's very and you will recognize that. I'm willing to bet there are branches of these companies within 2 miles of everybody's houses. We see it a lot in banks. We see it in retail, restaurants, very large restaurant chains. We've even got a report that there's a company using it inside medical devices.
Huh.
So it runs the gamut. There are major banks who have standardized on Entlib. You know, you get your new developer sits down, their developer machine has Visual Studio, the .NET framework, and Entlib on it. There are others who have taken Entlib as a base for their stuff, built on top of it, and then this is our enterprise framework. So yeah, it's made a lot of inroads just about every enterprise you can think of, and we're in a big chunk of the Fortune 500, for example.
Well, what causes people to start using it typically? In your experience, somebody picks up Entlib for the first time, why?
Entlib, in a nutshell, is a set of libraries that handle common tasks you end up doing in just about every kind of application. You know, every enterprise app and most non-enterprise apps need to do some sort of logging. The question is, are you going to write a logging framework again?
Ooh, yes.
You need to deal with data access. You need to deal with, caching. You need to deal with, security stuff. So people pick up Entlib because it's like, hey, this is something that will make that particular piece easier so I don't have to care about it. I just use it.
So, Chris, you mentioned framework. Do you consider Entlibrary a framework?
That is a very good question. A lot of people think Entlib is a framework. I personally do not think Entlib is a framework. And in fact, the name tells you what I think it is. I think it's a library. I suppose it depends on how you define framework. My definition of framework is a library is code that you call. A framework is code that calls you. So, for example, SharePoint is a framework. You slot stuff into the SharePoint system. Entlib, on the other hand, does nothing until you call it and say, please log this. Please, please connect to my database here, that sort of thing.
Have you ever sat with somebody who is experiencing an enterprise library for the first time, whether they're an experienced developer or a novice one?
That is a good question. It's actually been a very long time. I'd have to say, I remember when I was that developer.
Okay.
This was actually when Entlib 1.1.1 had just come out. Actually, it's funny, my first public presentation as a developer was actually on Enterprise Library 1.0, the Portland.NET users group. This was long before I had joined PNP. And the initial approach to Entlib is a little intimidating just because it's so big. In fact, Entlib has this, I think, undeserved reputation for being bloated because when you open it up and you look in the bin directory, there's like 117 assemblies in there, which just about everybody go, what's all this? It turns out you don't need them all at once. In fact, half of them are simply support for our config tool, and you don't even use them at runtime at all. But yeah, it is a bit of a trick to get your initial head around what pieces you need and what pieces you don't. But once you get that, once you get to that point, it's usually fairly straightforward. We spend a lot of time on our documentation. We do try to pay attention to how easy our API is to use, and you know, make it. The idea is to make the simple stuff as simple as possible. It's hard to find people, quite honestly, who've never heard of Entlib before. So,
okay, I'm wondering when somebody sits down and starts playing with it for the first time, what the biggest barrier to adoption is. It sounds like maybe size, and yes, just how big it is. So, if you're just going to focus on a piece at a time, that might be a better way to get started. Is what you're saying?
We do. Recognize that the complexity of the PNP deliverables is a barrier to adoption. We certainly learned that. I don't know if any of you guys have ever tried to use the composite application UI block. I think disappointing grunting in the back.
I think Jared and I both have experience with that one.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not fun. It's big. It's got a lot of moving parts, and you got to bite off all of it before you can use any of it. We have recognized that, and in fact, when we went to do the work on the composite scenario for WPF, the Prism project, we took a conscious decision that we weren't going to build it that way next time. We were going to try and make it as simple as possible to approach, to have the pieces as decoupled as possible so you could pick just what you needed, and make sure we had documentation explained all the moving parts. That was another big problem with CAB, is there was never really any real documentation for it.
So would you say that the Prism project or composite application guidance for WPF was more focused on identifying the patterns and the guidance, the kind of a how-to, nuts and bolts to build a composite application versus kind of forcing a huge framework?
That is actually a very good way to characterize it. I was not on the Prism project when it was in flight, but I was involved in some of the early discussions and architecture. And we went into it assuming that, or we went into it not assuming we were going to be delivering code. We specifically wanted to go in and identify patterns and pain points, and if the appropriate solution to that was just a white paper, then that was what we were going to deliver.
That's gotta be challenging, because on one hand, I've heard tremendous, some really great things about the Prism project and the guidance that it provides. Yet on the other, that for every one guy that's out there saying, hey, this is great, this shows me what I need to do to build a great WPF app, there's another guy out there actually taking the RI and, renaming things to make it fit his needs and running with that. And so, that could also pose a problem in itself.
Well, that is actually something we expect people to do. We're not thrilled when they do it, but we expect people to do it. So in general, our RIs aren't complete. I mean, they only implement enough to demonstrate what we're trying to show. But the stuff we do have in there, we try very hard to make sure that it is realistic and reasonable if it was put in a larger app.
So I actually heard a story about the inception of Prism and then that you guys actually went and built the application first, and then factored out all of the guidance, the pieces that you would need to compose the application, maybe versus a traditional approach where you might have built a large framework and then went and tried to build an application with it and realized, this just doesn't work.
Yeah. We're very big in, when we say, our motto used to be proven practices for predictable results. You don't get a proven practice until it's been done a couple of times, and we have been burned in the past, and we've seen other companies fail because they decided to build the framework first and then build the app on top of it. So particularly when we're trying to build something in a space that's new to us, like WPF was at the time, we will absolutely build an app or two first before trying to build any kind of infrastructure.
So I understand that the Prism project is going to be ported over to, or they're currently working on adopting that for Silverlight, making that Silverlight friendly. Maybe you can comment, and we can certainly edit this stuff out. Maybe you can comment on Unity's direction. I know that I had read a blog post from you a while back where you had taken Unity and you've got it to run in Silverlight. I was wondering how, you know, when can we expect Unity for Silverlight?
That's a very good question. And so I have actually been working on that for the last couple of weeks. The binary is ready. It needs to go. It went to our test team today. And as soon as it comes out of test, assuming that there's nothing really nasty in there, and actually the guys on the Prism project have been using this Unity binary internally for the past 2 weeks now. So I figure if there's anything seriously wrong with the container, they would have hit it. So the test is primarily doing things like, you know, installation checks and stuff like that. Once it comes out of that, we should be releasing it. So I'm hopeful that we should have that before the end of the year.
Awesome. Ooh, nice. Unity for Silverlight, heard right there.
Yep. And I was actually very happy because it didn't actually require any code changes to the container. So when we ship the source code for Unity, you'll get the Unity and desktop version. The only difference is the project files. And, of course, the fact you don't have any XML config in the Silverlight version.
Woohoo!
Some people consider that a plus.
It's all done with registry entries. What's the deal?
Yep. INI files for the win, man.
When you and I talked, Chris, at Seattle Code Camp, you were starting to think already about Intlib 5, right?
Yes.
So what's the general direction you see there?
So we have a couple of things that we want to do. Intlib is kind of unique among PNP assets in that it's probably the longest-lived thing we have. Intlib actually goes all the way back to the original individual application blocks that we released for .NET 1.0. And in fact, I know a lot of projects out there still use that old SQL helper class, that, you know, one class with, you know, 45 static methods on it.
What's wrong with that?
Well, at the time, it was better than what you had. So there's a bunch of stuff that, you know, quite honestly, is in the Intlib code because that was the way we'd always done it, and we know better things now, and there's new stuff in the platform. So I want to spend some time just cleaning things up, getting rid of old cruft that doesn't need to be there anymore. I also want to see if I can simplify things, particularly around our configuration system. And there's kind of a tradition that on Enterprise Library, about every two versions, we completely rewrite the config system, and then the person who rewrote the config system quits the program and starts drinking heavily. So if you see me in a bar sometime a year from now, you'll know what happened.
What's the difference between Unity and Math? What's the correlation between these two things?
So that has been a very interesting and evolving relationship over the last several months. So we knew that MEF was coming down the pike, you know, for quite a while, actually, before we even started working working on Unity. And before we started the project, we actually met with those guys and got their okay to say, we're not going to stomp on your toes here. And they gave us the okay. So we went out and delivered this thing, and then the MEF team started saying, no, we're the DI container for the .NET framework. You just need to wait a year. And having had further discussions and talking to them about what DI really means in terms of our application architecture, everybody's kind of come to the realization that what MEF is about is not really about DI. MEF is about extensibility. DI is an implementation detail of their extensibility story, but it's not really the focus. As such, I could see MEF and Unity playing together nicely within an application. There are things we do that MEF doesn't, and vice versa. One of the things we're thinking about is what does integration of the two mean? And also, from a purely practical standpoint, if MEF grows into a true DI container, then great. Let the product group maintain it. That's fine. I'll be happy to go on to something else. But it has to hit all of our scenarios for what Unity does, and it doesn't, and probably shouldn't, based on what their stated goals are. So I think the two are actually complementary. And if nothing else, us having a DI container from Microsoft out in the wild provides a fantastic opportunity for the MEF team to get feedback on how people are actually using these patterns that they would not have had otherwise.
So that's an interesting point. You know, Joe Developer out there using these patterns, and you guys bringing some of that stuff to people. Do you think the majority of developers out there get this whole inversion of control thing and the DI at the very beginning?
I think the answer is absolutely no. Okay. I'm hoping that by having a vehicle like Entlib to something that is already so wildly popular and consumed all over the place, that as we start using the DI style in our examples and talking about it, we will see more people pick it up because they'll see it really is pretty easy. And I remember looking at Castle Windsor, you know, 4 years ago and going, what the heck is this thing? It doesn't make any sense. I don't know why I'd ever possibly want this. And now, having played with it for a little while, I find it hard to believe I could do a significant application without it. So I'm hoping by providing more examples, providing an IP-safe way to look at it, that we will help Joe Developer pick up this stuff and build better software.
Okay. You guys have a, I don't know what the term is that you use for it, advisory council or committee or something like that, made up of industry folks?
Yeah, the advisors board.
Okay, advisors board.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how it impacts the direction that you guys take?
Sure. So we don't have a P&P advisors board. What we do is each project, as part of getting set up, we find an advisory board of people who are interested, experienced, and represent a good cross-section of our expected customer base. Now, each project runs things slightly differently, and the interaction with the advisory board changes from call to call, but typically there's conference calls every either 2 weeks to a month, depending on what the project is doing. In the early stages, it's usually, hey, we're thinking about doing this, we've done some experiments, let me show you our experiments, what do you think? In later stages, it's, here's what we've done, what do you think? Is there anything we've missed? Is there anything you think we should be investigating instead? Are we wrong? So it really provides a checkpoint and a sanity check to see whether we're hitting the things that people actually need from us.
And do the people in the advisory, you said advisory board, in the advisory board have an opportunity to play with bits as you guys develop, or not so much?
Typically, yes, although it's not, we don't typically do private releases to the advisors because most of our projects do a public drop at the end of every iteration anyway.
I see, okay.
Like, for example, you know, Entlib, we were running two-week iterations, and every 2 weeks, we drop source code on CodePlex for the public to check, except for the weeks I was sick. I really should automate that, shouldn't I? there are other things we will share, for example, research that we've done, or if we have some, like, you know, spikes experiments that we've done that wouldn't necessarily go out to the public, we would share those with the advisors, but hasn't been a whole lot of that in my experience.
Okay. So the other thing that you guys do that's sort of public facing is the annual P&P Summit. And I know that you're not exactly on the planning committee for that or anything, but can you tell us a little bit about the P&P Summit and what happens there?
Sure. So the P&P Summit is a regular conference, essentially. It's hosted by Patterns and Practices. Typically runs about 300 people. It's unusual for most technical conferences that there's only a single track. So it's not like you have breakout rooms and you have to decide from four different sessions to go to. Everybody sees everything. And typically our audience for that are senior developers and architects. And we talk about a fairly wide-ranging set of topics that you can fully expect there will be a presentation on every P&P project that's currently running. There's traditionally a keynote on, you know, the current and future of P&P. And then we get various Microsoft luminaries like Scott Guthrie did a keynote last year, or Yeah, well, last year was a couple, last month, I should say.
So the, you're talking about the fact that the latest P&P summit was just last month, right?
Right, exactly. We also, the P&P summit does, there are summits in other locations. Like, we just had a mini one in Nanjing, China last week, I think it was, last week or the week before last. And there's typically one, there was one in Quebec. And the same general idea, and we tend to talk a lot about things like design patterns and future things on the platform and the stuff we're currently working on, and we bring in other industry luminaries like, you know, Billy Hollis always closes the show with a talk on complexity and .NET development and, you know, Ryan Lotka.
And Billy always closes with why test-driven development sucks.
Right.
Have you heard that talk?
I've heard it twice, and it equally annoyed me both times. But it's funny, so
it's very funny.
It's a good way to end a conference.
And I should say here too for the listeners, Billy's going to be on the show here pretty soon, talking about some WPS stuff. So we'll have a chance to ask him about it directly.
Yeah, his math is wrong.
So, Chris, I understand you guys have just shipped the latest version of Entlib 4.1 with Unity 1.2. So, as a user of that of those tools, what would be the top three reasons that I would want to go check those out?
Okay, number one reason: bug fixes. Entlib 4.1 was primarily a bug fix release. I went trolling through our TFS server after we were done to find out exactly what we'd done. We fixed 114 bugs in about 6 weeks. Some of those had been bugs that had been hanging around since Entlib 2.0.
Excellent.
So, yeah, so that would be the number one reason, is because we've just fixed a ton of stuff. Let's see, number two, probably the biggest new feature: we integrated the policy injection block with the Unity container. So the policy injection block is sort of an aspect-oriented programming light, in that it's a way to hook up pre and post-processing to arbitrary object methods. The classic example of why you want to do that, you know, you want to log when certain methods are called every time. And when you're doing that, you need to put the log code to call the logger in the code of every single one of those methods. And it just, that cross-cutting concern just propagates through the entire code, and heaven forbid you change your logging policy, then you go back and edit every single one of those methods, and you got to get it exactly right every time.
Right.
Policy injection block lets you say, okay, for these four methods, call the logger before you call the method. And so then it wires it up.
And so then I could also use that for things like security and caching, exception handling, things of that nature.
Right. So what we've done, that was a standalone piece in 4.0. We've integrated that interception technology into the Unity container. So you can, if you're using existing PIAB code, still works exactly the same as it did before. But now you can put that PIAB configuration into your Unity container, and as you build up objects, we will also put the interception in place as we build up the objects. Which means that if you're building a complex object graph with Unity, if you were trying to do it with a PIAB, you got interception at the top, but that was it. If, when building it through Unity, you get interception all the way down the object graph in all the spots that you specify.
Very cool.
As a follow-on to that, the other thing we added was in PIAB, there was one interception mechanism. We were using the transparent proxy, real proxy stuff that was originally written for .NET remoting. That one had the advantage of being fairly easy to implement. It has the disadvantage that it's slow. So we finally had a lot of practice at dynamic code generation building Unity the first time, we added two new interceptors that are based on dynamic method and type generation, and they are our tests show they're about an order of magnitude faster. So as long as you meet the objects you're intercepting, meet the requirements for those interceptors, which we've documented as much as we can in the docs, so you know what you need to do, you can take advantage of that without having to change your actual PIAB code, just tweak your configuration a little, and you should get a significant speed up on those intercepted calls.
Excellent.
Okay, Scott, I'm not going to let you get away with this. I know that Scott uses Enterprise Library like a mad fiend. So, Scott, Scott, when was the last time you you actually touched one of these DLLs?
I've used every version of Enterprise Library, and I touched, last time I touched a DLL was 10 minutes before this talk. How's that for you? You know, I'm a real pragmatic about code, and I tend to... Entlib has saved me. I mean, yeah, you got to... It's a big, big beast. We've already talked about that. But honestly, the problems it solved for me have overcome any issues I've had. I mean, I just look at, hey, if I had to write this myself, man, I would have put a lot of work and effort into it. So luckily, the docs, I've always found them to be pretty decent. You know, now I'm getting into some more advanced scenarios now where I'm having a hard time where, you know, I'm starting to go into WCF connections everywhere. I'm looking at entity and things like that. And, you know, those pieces aren't quite there in Enterprise Library yet, right? So as I'm moving on to these more advanced, newer pieces of, you know, Visual Studio 3.5, you know, Entlib is playing a little bit of catch-up, and that's kind of a backbone of my architecture at the moment. So I got to figure out a way to make some of these things play a little nicer together. But other than that, it's been great. You know, the caching block I use everywhere. I don't necessarily use the data access block anymore, but logging is huge. And actually, what I was doing before this conference or talk was kind of tweaking the logging block to be a metrics collector. You know, I want timestamp metrics, you know, so I can see how long things are taking into a special interface. But no, I've been generally pleased with Enterprise Library, and 4.1 was nice. I did have an outstanding bug fix of one of my problems, and I remember I just upgraded the 4.1, and voila, some of my bugs just went away. So yes, I would definitely recommend to upgrade to 4.1. It did fix several of my problems.
Right on. So Scott actually mentioned something that is interesting there. What about the future of data access through Enterprise Library, Chris?
So that's a very thorny issue. I'm sure you can imagine, just based on recent events, that it's a fairly politically charged issue inside the company.
You mean that you guys are going to deprecate EF in favor of Enterprise Library for data access, or
who leaked that? Who leaked it? And of course, it wouldn't be Microsoft if we didn't come out with a new data access stack every 3 years. I mean, come on.
That's right. You got to keep up with tradition.
Yeah. So the underlying goal of the Enterprise Library data access block is to make calling stored procedures easier. Period. So you're not going to see an ORM tool come out of Entlib. In fact, you know, if somebody wants an ORM tool from Microsoft, we're going to point them at Entity Framework right now.
So you may take this one offline, but as a user of Entity Framework for probably about 18 months now, the TAP advisory board and all that, one thing that's really cool is in the EF extensions is the materializer, basically a shaper delegate that will take the outputs of procs and let you materialize object graphs out of them. So, you know, whenever we use a proc, we just always spin that thing up, and it, you know, it works really well. So I could see something like that fitting nicely into... you know, if that is your main concern, just being able to do more with the result set that you get back out of the proc. So.
What would think you were looking at my screen today?
Yeah, I spend quite a bit of time in that code and the expression visitor and all that stuff, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So having said that, PNP recently started up a project specifically around the data access question as a standalone project. So it's going to run for a couple of months. We're working very closely with the data access team, the guys who own both EF and Linked SQL. The expectation is the output of that project is going to be a series of a white paper or series of white papers, a couple of reference implementations, and then any code assets that come out of that are going to feed into Enterprise Library.
Oh, wow.
I can't really say what that's... I can't say what that's going to look like yet because it just started, but yeah, we are actively looking at that right now.
Okay. Do you have a project name that people might be able to watch for?
Right now, we're just calling it the Data Access Project. So.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, and I could say, Chris, too, on the data access stuff, you know, even though maybe the current DX is getting a little dated with all these new, linked to SQL entity coming out, what you guys have for data access, you know, just plain ADO underneath the scenes, it is fast, you know, faster than some of the OR mapping technology and whatnot. And I know, you know, I used to work for a very large corporation that had insane database and military sizes, and NLib has been able to keep up with that. It's impressed me. So, just some feedback there. I mean, keeping some of those around and not necessarily thinking you have to deprecate them and go into someone's other data access areas is not a big thing.
Yeah. Well, NLib has such a large user base that we are very, very careful about saying, no, this is deprecated. People still are going to use what we call it classic ADO.NET. If you're comfortable with it, if you've already got code that uses it, why change it?
Well, it has a place too, right? I mean, you can run. I mean, some of the ORM stuff. I mean, I love ORMs, but there are scenarios where it doesn't fit every scenario. Correct? I mean,
yes.
You can. So having those other data access methods in the toolbox, so to speak, is very helpful.
And so you brought up something earlier there about how you guys do have such a large following and a large user base. I know there's been some interesting blog posts this past couple weeks, past week, I guess I would say, about hiding internal members and maintaining backwards compatibility. What kind of challenges do you guys face with that?
So PMP as a whole, generally we don't worry about it. Most of our guidance offerings are essentially one-offs.
Yeah, because you guys are on a product team, right? So why would you need to be backward compatible?
However, NLib is a special snowflake, of course. So in general, on the NLib team, we try very hard to maintain backwards compatibility, at least on the source code level, for our public APIs. So, for example, even if we did, radically change the way that the data access block worked under the hood and made it call into EF. Not that I'm saying we're going to do that, but just if we did, we would still use the same series of public API calls so that you could just recompile your code and it would just work. There's just far too large an install base, and it's amazing how conservative many of these big enterprises are. We still get questions on a regular basis. Actually, I got one 2 weeks ago about a company that's like, I need this patch because this company's still using it, lib 1.0.
Wow.
And we actually pissed off a lot of people because the APIs from 1.1 to lib 1.1 to 2.0 changed significantly because we went, oh, we're sticking with the platform. The platform's moved on. Time to move on. And now that didn't work out so well.
So you just shifted the source.
Said that, yeah.
Go ahead.
And they had the source. Yeah, that's the thing that a lot of it's like, what happens if NLib goes away? I need we have companies asking us, I need dedication from Microsoft that NLib's not going to go away. And it's like, you have the source. How can it go away? Just recompile it and be happy. But strangely enough, that particular attitude doesn't win me a lot of friends. So. So I can kind of understand where the big enterprises come from. So we're working on a formal policy statement because a lot of companies are asking for it, but I think the gist of it is going to be we're not going to break your public APIs. However, we reserve the right to change the extension points under the hood for things like, removing Object Builder and putting Unity in, that kind of thing, or changing the way the config tool works to make it hopefully easier to add to the config tool, that sort of thing. Right, so we want to do a lot of work of just internal cleanup, making it simpler to consume, try to move the code more back to being guidance on good things to write, or good ways to write software. But there's also the question of, we've got this thing called .NET 4 coming out. Where does that fit? Does, just like we did when .NET 2 came out, we have to look at the current contents of the block again and say, do these still make sense? Is there something new that we can do? Or is there stuff that we should take out? And then the final thing is that we would want to work on what I've been calling NLib integration packs. Things like, we get questions all the time. How do I use Enterprise Library in a SharePoint app? How do I use NLib and where do I put the config if I'm doing an Outlook add-in? How would I use it in a WPF app or an MVC app? So we want to spend some dedicated time looking at those specific, looking at those environments, and we are taking we're taking nominations now for environments to look at, and actually produce dedicated releases to how to use Entlib in those spaces.
Oh, that's really cool. Okay.
Yeah, that'd be very helpful. Considering we have, five major presentation layers now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and the other one, the recently announced Windows Azure, the cloud platform, people are going to want to use it there. What makes sense, what doesn't, that sort of
thing.
Let's
add another one.
Yeah. So I also wanted to say, if people are interested in the future of Entlib, now is the time to start giving us feedback. Go to our CodePlex site, post on the on our discussion forums, or email myself or Grigory Melnick, who's the PM, and let us know what you want, because we are listening. Now is the time.
Well, Chris, man, we certainly appreciate the work that you do, not just your time tonight, but the work that you do in general, because I know that, speaking for myself, and I've heard Scott say it, I've used your work. I've used the product of your work, and it saved my bacon on a couple of different projects. So thanks, man. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Then I did my job.
Yes, time and money have been saved.
Woo!
And I appreciate
that for my next performance review.
Oh, right on. Please do.
Absolutely. We would love to see PMP continue for many years.
So would I.
All right, man. Well, we appreciate your time, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you. You maybe join us again another time.
I'd love to. Thanks much. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. The Elegant Codecast tries to bring you conversations with developers in the wild who are the best spokespeople for the software development craft. Give us your constructive or inflammatory feedback, as we are always interested in conversations with elegant coders. If you've got something to say and you'd like to say it on the Elegant Codecast, please drop us a line at cast@elegantcode.com. And remember to follow the drama of life as an elegant coder at elegantcode.com.